Welcome, everyone. This is Islam for Christians, episode 135, Islamic History, 625, The Battle of Uhud, Part 5. This will be the final Uhud episode. And so I kind of wanted to put it into some historical context. And so I was thinking of opening with some kind of parallel battle, like Bunker Hill in the American Revolution, or even an entire war like Korea. That was 1950, 1953. Now, these were conflicts which were close to a draw, but the winner and the loser was really in the eye of the beholder. However, I referenced Korea before. You may remember that. And Bunker Hill was 250 years ago, which isn't a big deal, but it's also generally not well known. Even in my own country, it's sad, but it's true. Americans, for the most part, we don't know our own history. If we did once, we don't now. But another term might kind of work here, which would be the term Pyrrhic victory. This is something that comes from the early days of ancient Rome, and it's basically when you win a battle but lose the war. And that's kind of what brought me to Bunker Hill. Because, you know, Bunker Hill was technically a win, but not really. You know, the Americans won the war as a result of Bunker Hill. Not directly, obviously, but again, a technical loss for the Americans, but something that would help them win the war in the end. And in that way, I think it's a very good analogy for Uhud, if you want to pick one of these things. The Meccans being the British and the Muslims being the Americans. So if you want a military analogy, I'm not going to go over it. Just look up the Battle of Bunker Hill. However, again, I did end up coming up with something that I felt was far better outside of the world of war. So I turned to the world of sports, soccer specifically, or football, or whatever you may call it, wherever you are. You know, it's that game where you kick a ball and you can't use your hands. Just imagine your team, your favorite team, the team that you love, has this giant match. You know, it's not a knockout game, sudden death, but it's a critical game where you're just trying to get some points in the standings, or the table, as the British say. The key here is a 90-minute match that can end in a tie. Right? That's kind of why this sport works. You know, this game, this imaginary game, let's say it had followed a massive upset victory over a legendary and high-quality team, and these players are really starting to believe that they might be worthy to hang with the big boys. And this imaginary team, this upstart team, they're winning 2-0 going into the final minutes. And then suddenly, bam, bam, the other team strikes twice to tie the game. And the final whistle blows, and you look at your friends in the pub. And now you have to decide how to feel. You didn't lose, right? That's good. You did get 1 point, but you didn't get 3 either. And you probably felt that you should have gotten 3. That 2-2 tie at 90 minutes doesn't feel nearly the same as some kind of dull 0-0 score at the end of 90 minutes. And what about the comeback team? You know, that feels like a win to them, even though they didn't actually win. So this imaginary team that blew a certain 2-0 victory is roughly equivalent to the Muslim situation after Uhud. After those 2 late goals, the Muslims stayed on the field, they buried their dead, and then headed back to the locker room of Medina. Now, you're going to have to talk to the press soon. What do you say? What do you tell the fans? We won? We lost? We choked? Well, it's complicated. That narrative will eventually unfold over the rest of the season. And it can be a sobering thing for a team that once felt invincible. Maybe you try to temper expectations a bit. You know, as a coach, what do you do? So back to real life. What did the Muslims tell their people? Now, here's a fascinating bit on how the Quran itself adjusted from Badr to Uhud. Now, there's a surah called Al-Anfal, the spoils of war. It's surah number 8. Most of this was revealed after the Battle of Badr, with some sprinkles coming from a later date. And one of those later revelations, allegedly, is verse 66. And it directly follows a similar proclamation issued after the Battle of Badr. If you remember that, that was a few years back. Great victory, okay? They had a lot more confidence then. Now, before I dive into this, I should note that what I'm about to talk about mostly comes from secular historians. Muslim commentators tend to ignore this or interpret these verses allegorically. So if you're a Muslim, just kind of skip ahead about 5 to 10 minutes. This isn't really going to interest you all that much. But for those of us interested in more of the raw history, even from just a non-religious perspective, regardless of religious affiliation, this is a really fascinating look at the Muslim mood after Badr and after Uhud, and the tempering of military expectations that came with it. All right, so this is Surah 8, verses 65 and then 66. They're very similar, but they're different. So here's verse 65, which was revealed after the Battle of Badr, the great Muslim triumph there, the military triumph. It says, O Prophet, motivate the believers to fight. If there are 20 steadfast among you, they will overcome 200. And if there are 100 of you, they will overcome 1,000 of the disbelievers, for they are a people who do not comprehend. So, if you want to do some quick math here, that's saying that one Muslim can take on 10 unbelievers. 10 to 1. It's a heck of a ratio. However, immediately following that in the Quran, we have a verse on the same subject that was, many believe, revealed after Uhud and kind of tempers expectations a bit and seems to be clearly directed at the results after Uhud. So this is verse 66, immediately following. Now Allah has lightened your burden, for he knows that there is weakness in you. So if there are 100 steadfast among you, they will overcome 200. And if there be 1,000, they will overcome 2,000 by Allah's will. And Allah is with the steadfast. So here's the reduced power of the Muslims being spoken. I mean, in truth, from God on high, saying, you can't do what you used to do. You know, so the reduced power of the Muslims, you see a new ratio. There's the new math. You can see the reduced power of the Muslim warrior there. This is the new ratio, 2 to 1, not 10 to 1. The power of the Muslim warrior has been reduced to a fifth of his previous power, from 10 to 1 to 2 to 1. The directive here is that the Muslims should not fight unless they have at least half of their enemy's strength. And this was the result of Uhud. Now, this is more than just God's opinion on a Muslim warrior. This is an actual change in military doctrine. This is how the Muslims would go forward. More math, less zeal. More cunning, less bravado. Now, I think a post-Uhud Muslim army, funny enough, would have never gone to Mount Uhud in the first place. It would have been called the First Battle of Medina, because That's where they would have set up a defensive perimeter, probably around Medina. Now, the Quran adjusted, the army adjusted, Muhammad adjusted, and the people adjusted. And without the Quran and without the genius of Muhammad, the adjustment that was made after Uhud could have been very, very different. Because, again, going back to the soccer analogy, maybe they didn't really lose, but they thought they did. So they needed an explanation for this, and a good one. Now, this was a community-shattering event, unlike any that they had actually experienced. Now, the Muslims had lost 70 to 75 soldiers in that battle, which doesn't sound like a lot to us, but it was certainly the most to date for them. And keep in mind, these are small communities, small numbers, small armies, okay? So just kind of adjust that for what the actual population would have been. You know, those casualties are just comically small by our standards today. Again, but huge for the people in those times. That was 10% of their army. 10% of the people on their battlefield died. And worse, the losses had been extremely lopsided between the factions of Medina. So that's causing some internal strife, because only 4 of those dead people were immigrants from Mecca. The rest were native Medinans from the Aus and Khazraj tribes. And this is a recipe for disaster in a society, not just the division of a community, but because this was largely seen as a loss by the Muslims. Fair or not, it's clear that they at least considered this not a draw, but a loss. And given their religious sensibilities, that was unthinkable. It undermined Muhammad's claim to have God on his side. If his God existed at all, was he really a prophet? If you claim that angels are fighting in the battle with you, what does it mean when you lose? Now, this is something you have to address. And not just address, you got to get ahead of it as much as you can. Now, the obvious thing to do in this situation would be blame the archers who left the hill. Pin it on them. Make a huge deal about it. Lay the entire loss at the faith of certain people not following orders. And the Quran actually does some of that, but not nearly as much as you might imagine, given the circumstances. Just on that subject, the Quran does say this. This is Surah 3, verse 152. Indeed, Allah fulfilled His promise to you when you initially swept them away by His will. Then your courage weakened and you disputed about the command and disobeyed after Allah had brought victory within your reach. Some of you, the archers, were after worldly gain, while others desired a heavenly reward. He denied you victory over them as a test. Yet, He has pardoned you, and Allah is gracious to the believers. And there's the divine explanation. So we do have cowardice, disobedience, and greed. Now, at the tactical level, that's what's being blamed. But ultimately, at the strategic level, the higher level, there will be a much larger claim being made here. And that is, God allowed this loss, and for some very good reasons. Now, yes, it looked like a loss, and it was a loss. But remember, God is up there playing four-dimensional chess, and you start to see various claims of God's strategy over time in the Quran, such as, listen to the messenger. You know, again, it's not just about the messenger, it's about the messenger. Don't just listen to God, listen to Muhammad, because Muhammad knows what God is saying. Now, Uhud helped to drive this lesson home and its importance, and this was a great opportunity for God to separate the believers from the hypocrites. And even God did this to further increase the guilt of the Meccans and to make their eventual defeat even more triumphant and humiliating. It actually sounds a bit like the old situation with Moses and Pharaoh. You know, just prolonging this thing and hardening Pharaoh's heart. It kind of sounds like a very similar thing that he was doing to the Meccans here, as claimed by the Quran. Now, what you don't see, somewhat surprisingly, is something like, hey, it wasn't that bad. You guys did great. There's no need to beat yourself up. It's okay. Instead, the Quran is actually using this for lessons on morality and really on an ultimate cosmology, something much, much bigger. As in, trust God. God's enemies will not win in the end. That sort of thing. But what it doesn't do is try to ease the pain of the loss. Rather, it just uses the pain of the loss for something constructive. So, if you think about it, in a way, God has taken a position on the question of whether the Muslims lost at Uhud. God says, yes, the Meccans won the battle, and the Muslims lost the battle, at least for the purpose of Quranic sermons. God's reasoning seems pretty clear there, but that's the moral world. Back in the amoral historical world, though, who would you say won this battle? And that's how I wanted to end this section on Uhud. Because at the beginning of all this, I talked about the Korean War, how it went back and forth, and how pretty much any faction of that war could claim victory or defeat. It was just a matter of how you wanted to look at it. And I want to stay in that spirit when looking at the winner of Uhud, because it's tempting to look at Uhud in the larger context, because we know what eventually happens. The Kaaba is not filled with pagan idols in the 21st century, nor would it be by the 8th century. We know how this ends. However, what if we didn't know how this ends? In that case, what would we say? That's what makes Korea such a good thought exercise, because we still don't know who wins the Korean War. It's not over. It's still going on. We're just in the middle of a very, very long ceasefire. That's why we only look at the period between 1950 and 1953, at the immediate aftermath of that. So, in that frame, assume you don't know how this ends, and you're a resident of Medina, and you're in the immediate aftermath of the Battle of Uhud. Now, here are some facts that you have to deal with. The Muslims lost twice as many people as the Meccans. They lost control of the battlefield. On the other hand, the Muslims still had their home. Islam was still a force. Muhammad was alive. Their situation didn't really get any worse. So we should look back at the largest, overriding, most important objectives of each side coming into this, just like we did with Korea way back when. The Muslims wanted to survive, to remain a strong and united force in Medina. Now, the Meccans, what did they want? They wanted to destroy Islam as a force and get clear passage for their caravans. So when you look at those objectives, who won? From a raw historical perspective, the morality play and the Quran and all that notwithstanding, at least in my opinion, the Muslims won this battle. They met their objectives. They survived as a religion and as a powerful force and as a headache for Meccan caravans. The 75 dead warriors, as sad as that may be, it doesn't change any of that. They were in Medina as a coherent force, if not possibly a weaker one. I'm talking about the Muslims here, not the 75 dead warriors. They were still there and a force to be reckoned with. And Meccan caravans would not be going north anywhere near them, which is another failure for Mecca. And Muhammad himself was alive and in charge in Medina. That's another failure for Mecca. And I see this odd situation of a winning side mourning their victory. Again, the 75 warriors, I get that. But from a larger strategic military perspective, this was a win. It only felt like a loss because the win could have been much, much larger. And again, this wasn't without cost. 75 warriors, including Hamza. The scoreboard favored the Meccans, roughly 2-1 in casualties. But ultimately, in the cold calculus of military power, does that really matter? No one claims that the Germans won World War II just because their casualties were lower than the casualties of the Russians. Similar thing here. Now, yes, it was tragic, and the numbers are still eye-popping. I mean, when you look at World War II, I think the combined deaths between the German and the Russian armies were like 45 million. However, Russia won, and they still celebrate that victory. The objective was to drive the invaders from the homeland. And they did that. And the Muslims did the exact same thing. Now, granted, that's not perfect. The Russians eventually had to go all the way into Germany, and they would. You know, if I were to draw an analogy here, I wouldn't say it was quite Stalingrad, but quite getting close to Stalingrad. I would say the Battle of the Trench, which we get to, that's going to be Stalingrad. And then, spoiler alert, I'm sure you know, eventually the Muslims end up marching into Mecca the way the Russians marched into Berlin. But what about the battlefield? You remember the mutilation of Hamza. Now that only happened. That was only possible because the Meccans won control of the battlefield. This is true. But also, so what? Napoleon once held Moscow. How did that work out for him? The French invaders soon had to flee. You know, no one thinks of the taking of Moscow as a French victory. And really, I see something similar at the Battle of Uhud. Well, not again, not Napoleon, Russia. That's a whole other thing. They weren't limping back and dying in droves, but they simply had the inability to hold the territory that they had just won, sort of, on the battlefield. Now, the Meccans, you could argue, fled. This was supposed to be a war of annihilation, but it turned into what was basically a punitive raid. The Muslims achieved none of their objectives. Sorry. The Meccans achieved zero of their objectives. The Muslims achieved plenty of their objectives. This was a very narrow victory for the Muslims, but in my opinion, a victory nonetheless, even if it didn't feel like a victory. On the other hand, I wouldn't call it decisive for either side. This wasn't like Badr, as we went over before, or some of the battles that will come after this. And I actually use the word battle sort of loosely. You'll see what I mean as we go on. But the Battle of Uhud in isolation is not hugely significant from a military perspective. Now, it was from a religious perspective, from a moral perspective, from a societal perspective. And again, we just went over that in how the Muslims interpreted Uhud. But it was more of an equalizing battle. Now, the two armies met on a proper battlefield, and it ended up being pretty even. And in the immediate aftermath of the battle, both sides seemed to agree, you know what? It's a tie. Let's move on. Now, technically, the Muslims chased the Meccans afterward. I believe it was a day or two afterward, maybe one, I think like the next morning. Only, it wasn't really a chase. This was just some kind of Arab customary thing, because Arabs are supposed to chase raiders after a raid to save face. And I suppose in their eyes, this was technically a raid. So you chase after raiders because that's just what you do. Only they did so only in appearance, half-heartedly, which still counts, you know. But again, I wouldn't call it a chase. Just imagine you're in a movie and the chase scene starts with, hey, let's get them. Well, let's get a good night's sleep first. Then we'll chase after them. It would be kind of weird, but that's what happened here. It was ceremonial posturing and no one was really going to fight. And the Meccans left slowly too, for similar reasons, so that they could pretend that they were not being chased away. Now, at a point, the two parties got somewhat close, and the Muslims made a display of lighting a whole bunch of fires at night to pretend they had a large army. And I'm sure the Meccans knew they didn't, because, you know, they stayed for a few days. That's just me speculating. I don't know this for sure. You know, but they just wanted to show that they were not scared. And then they left for Mecca. They didn't retreat to Mecca. They left to Mecca, not being chased, just leaving. And then the Muslims went back to Medina because they had done their duty and pretended to chase the so-called raiders. Which is so fascinating, just from a human behavior standpoint. Because this is really one of those strange, ego-driven, face-saving, and seemingly empty rituals from the ancient world that I simply don't understand, regardless of which society is doing it. This is basically performative machismo. It's kayfabe, like professional wrestling. It's a delicate, scripted dance to assuage some primitive, prideful impulse in the hearts of certain men. Now, it's seen, again, from our perspective way over here in the 21st century, it seems like an odd thing to employ in a war when everything is at stake. Because if one side breaks the script, all hell breaks loose and everybody loses. Now, even imaginary fighting results in injuries. Just look at the death of all those professional wrestlers over the years. And this isn't wrestling. It's an actual honest-to-God war. Just imagine if a real fight broke out. I mean, what would that look like? Where would it go? If someone broke the script at a time when one or both were particularly vulnerable. You know, just think of that dance that the Meccans and the Muslims just did. What if it went wrong? What would have happened? You know, from our perch here in modernity, bizarre doesn't even begin to describe this behavior, which, to be fair, is a very good sign that I'm just not thinking very hard about this or not trying hard enough to see it from their perspective. So when you look at this so-called bizarre behavior, again, like this chase, the Muslims pretending to chase the Meccans and the Meccans pretending to, you know, do what they did, it seems less bizarre if you think about it for a while and try to give more modern takes on it. For example, the Cold War. Perhaps that was an example of this phenomenon that we can understand a little better. You know, perhaps if done correctly, this song and dance nonsense, it can prevent a lot of violence. Of course, that is if it all works out in the end, which the Cold War did. Well, at least over here, you know, in my country. I don't think the Soviet era was, the whole Soviet experiment was helpful to Russians or anyone else in their orbit in the end. But as far as avoiding casualties, as far as the two sides pretending to fight and save face, it was an impressive dance for about a half a century. And no one annihilated anyone in the end. And in the future, you know, 1400 years from now, when some guy's doing a podcast on the Cold War, this whole thing's going to look just as stupid to him. You know, very similar to how we see what the Meccans and the Medinans just did. especially considering this isn't the end. They know it's not the end. Everyone knows it's not the end. But for this single battle, that silly dance that both sides are doing is basically an acknowledgement that, okay, our two sides just faced off. They decided the playing field was level. Everyone did okay. So that's it. Now, each side will assess their strength, and they will decide where to go after the Battle of Uhud. Thank you, and I'll talk to you next time. Inshallah. Thank you for listening to Islam for Christians. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to keep this show ad-free, you can also visit my Patreon page and subscribe. I'm at patreon.com/Islam for Christians. That's patreon.com/Islam for Christians.